coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody and good Tuesday evening. I hope everybody is having a great South by Southwest. If you are out there in the madness of South by Southwest, take care of yourself. Be safe. If you're a technician like me, make sure to drink water. Make sure to sleep. All right. I know it can be crazed, but man, is it a fun event. We have a great show for you tonight, folks. Very, very happy to welcome back Hakim Isler. He is the founder of Cygames International, an amazing first of its kind of event that will be testing and challenging people in psychic ways, in the ways of remote viewing, clairvoyance, telekinesis, psychokinesis, things like that. So it's going to be a fascinating few days that is coming up August 1st through 3rd in Charlottesville, Virginia. You can get tickets right now. They are available. We will have a coupon code for you at the end of the show, things like that. And in the second part of the show tonight, we will be joined by our friend Edward Mung, who has just made the Sierra Sounds a prelude. He has created a documentary with Ron Moorhead, famed Bigfoot researcher, who recorded the Sierra Sounds at his camp in the Olympia Mountains. And it's a really, really neat 20-minute in-depth with Ron and his wife about the events that happened up there, and really lays out the depth and breadth of what the full-length documentary is going to be about. So we'll be talking about that in the second part after a commercial break. Our first guest tonight, Hakim Isler, is an actual ninja. And in addition to that, a remote viewer. He also teaches these concepts to youth in all kinds of classes. Welcome back to the show, Hakim. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, what's going on? I'm doing good. How's everything going over there? I saw you was, weren't you in Texas? You were at South by Southwest.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I had a three-day private event that I provided some AV for and a couple of technicians, things like that. So it was actually awesome. It's the first time actually in a couple years that I have had a South by gig. It used to be a big point of pride, even though I lived in Austin, that I did a huge oil and natural gas event in Houston during that time. So like as South by would start, I was like, see you madness. I'm creeping to Houston for 10 days. but it's nice to be back in the fray. It's great. And we had a great event over at a place called Q Branch, which is very much a vertical lift company that helps people get into vertical business spaces, things like that. And there was some cool stuff, man. Second Front was there. They do a lot in the world of bringing companies to government work and preparing company infrastructures for things like top secret clearances. How do you get your profiles for security for your software and things like that? Really cool. And then another one that was First Nations House. Which is what I got to do, which was a bunch of First Nations people talking about the challenges in front of them in their communities, things like that, and even breaking through in tech and industry. So really fascinating stuff. It's always fun, always cool. And even your event, I am greatly looking forward to, because as someone who puts events on, you're always hard pressed to find a new way to do something. Yeah. Hakim, it's one of those like, oh, what's the show going to be this year? But this isn't like your normal remote viewing event, even though there will be speakers there talking about such things, stuff like that. How did you first come to the world of remote viewing to begin with?
So remote viewing out of my skill sets, that came up as a part of my ninja training. And so the ninja had these different abilities, nine specific powers, they called them, or abilities, and that they would work on. And remote viewing was one of them. It's like Kuji 7. Sometimes it could be, yeah. So that Kuji 6, 7, and 5, they all kind of blend together in how the mechanism in which they use. And so that's where I first got introduced. But I was young, and my teacher told me that when he first came back from Japan, there were so many people who were really interested in understanding and knowing about the ninja. And since he was in Ohio, he was in Centerville, Ohio, there was a guy named Del Graff, who I didn't know who that was at the time, you know, who approached him and did these things where, I like how that's on a Kung Fu website.
I know, right?
Which is not, I mean, now, to be fair, actually, you know, a lot of the finger weaving and stuff and all of the hand tying and the mudras and the mantras and the yantras, they come out in India and they found their way to China and Tibet.
Yes.
And into Japan. So maybe that's some of the connection. But anyway, so he told me that he linked up with this guy, Del Graff, and then Del Graff was working on this project and had made him sign a bunch of papers saying that he couldn't say anything for a number of years. And then he proceeded to work on this remote viewing stuff. And, you know, this was years later when I heard about it after the project was done and he could talk about it. But it still was kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, that sounds cool. But, you know, I'm a 20-year-old and I still like the physical stuff, you know, even though I dabbled in a lot of the esoteric and the meditation and stuff like that, I still was more heavily into the physical. Mm. And later on, only a few, you know, several years ago, I was having these instances with children at my martial arts schools where they would be pretending to be these ninja characters in these animation movies like Naruto and things of that nature. And they would be putting finger tying and doing their mudras and, you know, calling, you know, energy from different places and pretending to do that. And I told them like, hey, you know, we have things like this in our martial art. And they would just be like, oh, you know, how do I do it? And really I didn't have an answer other than, hey, you know, train with me for a long time. Then we work with my teacher. And then maybe one day, you know, you'll have this experience. And for a kid, that's just not exciting. You know, it's training all this time. They want something now. And so I was like, you know, how do we keep the kids interested? Well, we really need to come up with a way for them to tap into their own potential in a very clean and concise way that they can have an experience now with, because they're living in they're the now generation. And so I started looking and remote viewing popped up and I found my teacher, Paul Smith. And I was like, you know, if this guy has a protocol, and I started researching him and I was like, oh, the army thing. And oh yeah, that's right. My teacher told me about this. And so I was like, I'm going to go out there and train with him and see what it's like. And that's what started my journey there.
And it's amazing that it began so organically for you. I guess my first exposure to the concept of remote viewing, seeing things at a distance, was reading into ninjutsu in junior high and high school. the work of Stephen Hayes, things like that. We've talked about this on the show before. Even my good friend Billy Stewart says all the time, like, I remember I came over to Chris's house and saw the book Secrets of Ninja Invisibility on his bookshelf. And I was like, this dude's on a totally different level. I can hang out with this guy. But even in that book, it was the idea of projecting forth the non-presence, so to speak, the idea of projecting into somebody's mind the idea that you are not there. And it was fascinating to me, the idea of like, wait a minute, this is telling me that I need to project a thought into somebody else's mind. And that was pretty fascinating to me, the idea of even being able to do that and being able to see your enemy around corners, things like that. being able to see the layout of a place at a distance. It was really fascinating. And it wasn't until many years later that I found actual remote viewing.
Yeah. That one you just mentioned, seeing inside a building, that's remote viewing, you know? Yeah. So they didn't call it that because they didn't have an Ingo Swan like we did, but
yeah.
That was the idea. And, you know, projecting thoughts into people's mind, all these different abilities are abilities that they worked on as a means to keep themselves alive in this very tenuous environment where, you know, these people were trying to take them out, and they had better equipment, and they spent, and they knew warfare really well, you know, and they wanted these guys to be done with. And so they had to use every thing at their disposal. And so what sometimes these spiritual gifts that these folks would say are ignoble if you use them or dishonorable, these guys were like, no, we're just trying to survive. You know, we're using not to really hurt you, but really to know where you are, stay away from you, gain information. But, you know, in the process, of course, this is, you know, things could go wrong and I'll have to do myself and so on and so forth. But that was their ultimate goal. So, yeah, that was my first introduction to it. And then how I started in remote viewing.
Now, let me ask you this. Whenever you're talking about using these innate gifts, like you're saying, like a samurai wouldn't do such things because it was dishonorable to do such things in combat. But, you know, there are a rank and file of people, even to this day. A prime example, when I posted the ad, it was a comment from my brother, you know, on Facebook, where I got an alert and it was like, Randy Jordan commented on your post. And it was like, oh, let me go see what my brother said. And it was a post on the boosted ad that I did for Cygames. And brother, my brother's comment was, you know, wow, the trolls in here are golden. and I mean, it ran the gamut, man. For everything from sorcery to Satanism to all kinds of things. And it was like, whoa, hold on, people. Yeah. Like, these are innate gifts that are there. You know, this is the idea that you're basically a receptor at this point, that there is something else that not takes over you in a possessive kind of way or any kind of. And I guess, you know, there is an akin in some ways to astral projection, things like that. But it's much more the fact of you're receiving all of this stuff all the time. The question is, are you filtering it out and considering it nonsense, or are you taking it into a data pool?
Yeah. That's very true. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we are still there, you know, as open-minded as we are in some ways, we're so very closed-minded in other ways.
Yeah.
If you think back, there was a time that a person could be sick and another person could say, oh, I know what you need. You know, you need this plant. You need some echinacea, or you need some ashwagandha, and mix it up and it heals you. And or have a cut, and I make a poultice and I put some plantain on there, you know, and it heals your cut. And people would say, this person's got to be a sorcerer or evil or something of that nature. Yeah. And it took us a while to get past that idea and say, oh, no, wait a minute. This is just natural healing, you know, but for a long time, those people would be, you know, destroyed and killed. And instead, we'd rather use leeches to blood suck out of people, you know, what we think is wrong with them. And, you know, and then but meanwhile, the plants and herbs that we have on the planet, we couldn't use those. Somebody would think we were evil. So we're kind of facing that same thing where people think that, you know, all these gifts are, you know, bad, when, you know, it's very clear that regardless of where you come from, most religious organizations believe that we were kind of created using, you know, the breath of whatever being that created us, you know? And so it's like, okay, if we have those, if we're a reflection of that, why wouldn't we have some lower level of that ability to see things or connect with others or what's happening. And, you know, but of course it's got to, if you can't do it or you feel like you can't do it, that's really what I want to say clearly. If you feel like you can't do it or you don't want to do it, then you just got to, you know, misery loves company. You got to pull somebody else down and say that they're
true,
regardless of what they're doing with it.
You know? Yeah. And it's one of those, you brought up the creation story, and many faiths believe that concept. And it is a guiding principle in Kabbalah.
Yeah.
The idea that because we amongst creation were uniquely breathed into by the same breath that spoke the universe into creation, that we take part in that creative spirit.
Yes.
You know, that is why, like, we have the same divine vibration going through us, and we can resonate divinely throughout the universe. You know, so it's fascinating to think about that and to consider that. And when you start looking at that idea, especially when it comes to connection all around, because I was a Roman Catholic seminarian. We were taught prayer and that kind of stuff. But it wasn't till later when I started studying Buddhist meditation, that kind of stuff, that the idea of silent connection with the world around and really tuning into that divine frequency, so to speak. And really, that's no different than, let's say, what ninjutsu did for you, Hakim. It's not like through ninjutsu that you gained these. It's not like when you hit third degree black belt, they bestowed the powers upon you.
Yeah.
You know, the powers were there. These disciplines helped you hone them.
Yes. Yes. And I love that you say that, because the truth is that I was already, and there are several stories that I've shared with other folks that, you know, I had dreamt the lotto when I was a kid, and my mom played it locally instead of nationally, and it came out nationally.
Wow.
We would have a lot of money. I foresaw this kid's bat flying out of his hand and hitting somebody in the head, which it looked like it was going to be me. And so I had that premonition. I moved, and within a few seconds, the person who took my spot, the bat slips out of this guy's hand and smashes this kid in the head. That would have been me if I didn't have that moment. And so I remember those very vividly, those times in my life. And I say to myself, well, okay, I was already dealing with that ability way before. A matter of fact, one of the things I told my mom when I was 9 years old, her and my aunt asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said, I'm going to be a ninja. Right.
Nice.
And they laughed and they thought it was cute, because they were like, there's no such thing. Excuse me. And I forgot about it. I didn't think anything of it. And then years later, I have this really life-changing experience. I decide that I want to dedicate my life to martial arts, but I'm not sure which one. And through some auspicious circumstances, some really, you know, out there circumstances, I end up meeting with a friend, and he told me about the ninja, and I went to look it up and found out it was a real thing, and found my teacher's book, and there starts the quest. And within 2 years, I'm telling my mother, I'm going to go and train with this guy, live in Ohio where I know no one, and train with a ninja.
She was
scared and blown away at the same time, because she said, you knew all this time. I said, what? She said, when you were 9, I asked you what you wanted to be, and you said you were going to be a ninja. And she said, and now here you are telling me all these years later. She was like, this is crazy. And so I knew this is what I was going to be on some level. I said it out loud. I spoke it into either I spoke it into existence or I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And I was speaking about it. Yeah. Either way, it's still identifies that those abilities were there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because that is one of the topics that we talked about on the Irva Cruz. It's one of the topics that we talked about with Greg Radabaugh when he was on the show recently, was that idea of not just binary choice into the future, but actively looking into the future and seeing events. And and how those things quantumly change. You know, there could have been a good three. And if you go back in your life, folks, you'll see things like that. Like the prime example that I give people is my wife. I would not be with my wife if I never entered the seminary.
Mm.
If I never entered the seminary, I would have never known about a Holy Trinity Seminary where I went in Irving that was attached to University of Dallas, which was where I was made to go. Kind of first test of obedience. This is where you're going to college.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations, you're in. And without that, I would have never made the friends that I made, wanted to come back to University of Dallas after a year off, and then met her.
Mm.
You know, so there are very, very interesting quantum points there where I had a chance to make a decision and pivot, and the path of things would have been totally different.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting to see that at 9 years old, you were so resolved, because it's not like, you know, I want to be a fireman. You said, I'm going to be.
Yeah.
And there's a difference there. There's a very distinct difference there of will and consent into that willful system, you know, of I will be this, you know, and determination. So even the idea of that, Hakeem, and how that impacted you and how that drove you in life, fascinating to look at and to consider the fact that, you know, you could have fluenced yourself out of that at some point.
Yes, that's so true. That is so true. You're absolutely right. 100%. And it didn't seem like that was my trajectory. I mean, I forgot all about those guys, you know, like, or at least that statement. And all I knew of the ninjas were Ninja Turtles and all this stuff. You know, I didn't know that it was a real thing, and it came back into my life. It birthed itself, like the side games is doing in my life right now. And so that's one of the really special moments in my life.
And I imagine so. You know, I know quite a few people who have gone through multiple belt degrees of a martial art, come to the point of becoming an instructor in that martial art, things like that. But I would say that along with maybe like Shaolin or something like that, ninjutsu is right there, because it is definitely a dedication to a lifestyle.
Yeah.
As opposed to just a martial art. And it's really fascinating to look at that. Let's get into how the aspects of ninja help you actively in the daily in that kind of way. The concepts of intuition, things like that, Hakeem.
Yeah. So ninjutsu, it means the art of perseverance or endurance. To put up with, it could also mean the art of stealth, but stealth not in a very cheesy, low level way. It's stealth in a way in which we're discussing this idea of how to be invisible to the things that would seek to harm me, right? Or seek to see me not succeed. How to be invisible to those things, and that doesn't always mean it's a person. It could be your own self. It could be a family member. It could be a process, a policy, whatever the case may be. It doesn't have to be an actual person. It could be a multitude of things. And so the ninja have very specific rules and principles that allow them to kind of move through these different places and be able to figure out the best way for them to succeed in these different areas. And so this has always come up in my life. And the Kuji, these nine, powers, nine syllables, nine powers, nine cuts, you know, they have, you know, depending on which way you're doing it. And, you know, they're a very packaged way of saying, this is what I'm trying to bring forth in my life. I need more healing. I need more strength, mental, emotional strength. I need to be able to sense those things that might want to harm me right now. I need to be able to see what's going on in a place where people might be doing things or saying things that would affect me and my family's life. I need to, like, you know, Kujiate manifestation. I need to be able to manifest things into my world and my reality, you know?
Yeah.
So these tools were tools that, you know, on an esoteric level really could help your non-esoteric level, you know, of living and being, because you were able to tap into these gifts and develop these gifts in a way that they were going to be or help you be successful in your world and help the people around you be successful in their world. So it's funny. I have a school. I have two schools. And one of the things that I say when people come into the schools is they'll say, you know, hey, I don't know about this ninja stuff. You know, I can't be a ninja. And I'm like, well, have you ever endured or persevered over any hardship in your life? And they'll say, yeah. And I say, well, you're by definition, you are already a ninja.
That's right.
Now it's only my job to train you in the principles that they had to help them do that better.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're like, whoa, okay. I've never heard it like that. You know, yeah. I'm already a ninja. Okay, cool. You know, yeah. So they'll do that thing. And I'm like, yeah, we're all there, you know, by the definition of what the word means.
Well, and you know, that I think is the number one, it's the main principle of any martial art is the idea of, the only thing you ever have control of is your reaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, you know, and your measured reaction at that. So the idea of learning to recognize these things when they happen in real time.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Learning to see that moment of manifestation when it occurs in real time.
Yes.
You know, things like that. That is what the training is for.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the manifestation isn't already happening. Not that you aren't already manifesting things in your life. You may not be honed enough to realize that the manifestation is happening because it's not happening by the prescribed way that you have laid out. You know,
yes.
You've definitely given it a box of like, this is what I want the manifestation to be. And it may pop up as a sphere over here, but because it's not a box, you're not paying attention. You know.
Yeah. You know what's funny? I had this epiphany. It's kind of along the lines of what you're saying. For a long time, I thought my talent was, mind sight. I can see things without my eyes. That's my talent. Oh, remote viewing. That might be my talent. That's the thing, you know, blah, blah, blah. And what I just recently realized after all of these years of me training in these things and doing this stuff is that my true talent is whatever I say comes into existence. So if I say I want to be a good remote viewer, it happens. And it's not necessarily me. I mean, I put in the work, but it's not necessarily about the gift I have to be a good remote viewer. It's that I spoke about that gift and boosting that gift. And so my power is actually manifestation, not these other things. And so I was just like, whoa, that really blew me away, because what ended up happening is this, my ability to do and create was manifesting itself in its truest form, but through the things that I wanted to happen in my life. And I thought it was this, and it really was this. You know, I thought it was, I just got the knack for remote viewing, you know? And it was really like, no, I keep saying I want to be a good remote viewer, and I bring those things into existence. I end up doing a palm leaf reading, and the guys, you know, found my palm leaf and was doing this thing with me. And they spoke on that Zoom. They say, you know, something, your ability is your throat chakra, and it's going to open up, and you're going to, and you're going to have to be very careful, because whatever you say is going to come into existence. And I was like, really? And they were like, yeah, you're going to get to a point where every time you say something, it's just going to pop up. And even after having that conversation, I still didn't recognize that.
Yeah.
That difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things pop up all the time. And that's where you have to be very open when you ask for things or when you want things, because they'll pop up and they'll come in a way that's unexpected. And you may not see them for what they truly are.
Yeah. Yeah, no, precisely. And you may well, that's literally what I used to teach junior high and high school students about prayer, is you cannot put prayer in a box.
Yes.
You cannot. You cannot. Because you are asking the universe to move for you, and you need to be willing to move and flex for the universe.
Yeah.
Which means allowing the definitions of what you are asking the universe for to move and flex to what you need. You may be utterly, and the example I used to give was you could pray to the universe all day long to pass geometry because you didn't study. You know what the universe wants? For you to study geometry. It wants you to put the work in.
Yes.
Because it's like a slinky. And I used to actively give them all a slinky the first night of class. And, you know, the idea of like, just look at the slinky. You can't touch it. Don't play with it. And even when we did touch it, you just held it in your hand. It's like, look at all that sprung up potential.
Yeah.
But until you move it, it doesn't slink.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything until you push it.
Yeah.
You've got to be the one to push it and put the energy in to the system. It's not a zero sum return system. Like, that doesn't exist in physics.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have an initial push of energy, and then you can multiply the energy. You can do whatever you want, but you've got to have an initial push.
Yes.
You know, and it's fascinating to think about that. It's really interesting to think about how that relates to so much in your life, whether it's ninjutsu or remote viewing, what have you. Let's get in a little bit to the nine cuts and how they relate to life, Hakeem, because once again, it really is an interdisciplinary system between mind, body, spirit that you are building with these nine.
Yeah, yeah. So you got the strength, strength, physical strength. You got health sciences, like understanding like the things you need to be healthy. You got that's the external health sciences, the internal health sciences, the things that you need to be healthy on the inside. You have understanding and feeling, intuition, and knowing what dangers are, what could be coming your way. You have these, and actually probably cleaner if you just bring them up and we can go down them instead of me just like pulling them off. And then we can just kind of hit those each point and I can kind of go in a little bit more detail.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find a good source for all those. Here's one. I mean, here's one from Way of the Ninja. It's got everything in its original Japanese though.
Don't go to Way of the Ninja unless you want to like really be a ninja. No, the Kung Fu one I think came up and it had a list and
okay. That was yeah. There we go.
And I think if you scroll down or something, it had like a little list of them and then we could just go right through them. So
that it there?
No, that's not. That's some of them, but that's not as clean as.
Ah, there we go.
All right. So, your Ren really is what we call, that would be your strength, your ability to capture and grow in strength. You know, this idea of, having the strength you need physically, having the strength you need mentally and emotionally and really balancing that out. And then your pyo, this idea of, we call it in our school to make it really easy. We call it the health sciences, external health sciences, learning how to, learning what you need to do to stay healthy on the outside and deal with that energy wise and how you direct your energy, which is talking a little bit about here. It's going into It's going into some things that we don't necessarily have with like the fire and all that stuff. I mean, it can be related to some degree to some of the elements, but not really doing it really well. Toe, which is, it could be harmony. We call it internal sciences. And really understanding and understanding how to maintain good health on the inside and really understand what's happening internally and what you have going on there. And then you have Sha and this healing, you know, this idea of being able to remote heal people. You know, we know it as healing, you know, being able to lay hands on people and heal them and understand what it is to be able to do that. And again, that's not always using just energy, but I mean, I could be using, like I said earlier, a poultice or a plant or something to heal someone. Then Kai, which is intuition. This is like what we know of as like sensing danger, being able to be aware of things that might harm you. Right. Yeah. So, you know, this idea of as we move into controlling time and space. So that would be really close to getting close to like between 6 and 7 is kind of like this dance, because it's like remote viewing in the sense that, especially that number 6, where I'm able to be beyond time and space and I can go places and get information and be places and things of that nature. So then you have this number 7, which is really this idea of being able to manifest and bring things into the world that you want. Number 8, Jin, awareness, being able to be aware of things on all levels, how those things are moving, how those things are feeling, what's happening over here, what's happening over there, being very aware of all things in time and space and not just a few. And then this last one is absolute enlightenment. And between that 8 and 9, there was a phrase that my teacher's teacher said, where it's like the mind and eyes of God, this idea that God sees everything, God knows everything, and things happen in the scheme of totality, the way they're supposed to happen. And as human beings, that's really difficult for us to understand. We often have those questions. Why did this person have to die? And why did this have to happen? And why all these people have to suffer in order to get to this thing? And, you know, we're always thinking on a very logic based level, but maybe if there is a, you know, in this idea of a greater entity that, you know, that can see beyond time and space and knows all the ins and outs of the things that are happening, then maybe it played a greater role. And it's really hard for our brains to wrap our minds around that when you say, oh man, all those people had to suffer for what, you know, and then you know, and then 1,000 years from now, you realize that because those people suffered then, it opened the door for all of this great advancement for, you know, for people in this modern day, you know? And so, it's hard to think about that, you know, it wouldn't make sense to our brains in a lot of levels.
You know, it's very hard. The concept of suffering leads to enlightenment, you know, and especially when you're looking at the way that the world works, it's very, very hard. Like we said a minute ago, it's hard for us to pray for things or try to manifest things and not have them inside a specific box.
Yes.
You know, not be able to see them outside of the definition that we gave them. And that really is, it's a special mentality. And yes, it can be trained. I think that we all have the ability. The way I explain it in my industry is a forest and a trees mentality. You have to be able to see both the forest and the trees, meaning the big picture and every little piece of minutia that makes up the big picture.
Yes.
At the same time, simultaneously. Yep. And not everybody is able to make that differentiation. Not everybody is able to see the way that all the small little cogs make a very large machine that moves things the size of the world and reality around us, Hakeem.
And we're a spark plug trying to see the car.
Trying to see the car, trying to see the wheel move.
Yeah. We want to see the whole car, but we're just in here under the hood, inside this cap, you know,
and a vital part of the machine's movement. Without that spark, there is no combustion. There is no motion. There's nothing. Yep, you know, once again, you've got to push the slinky.
Yes.
It's got to happen, you know? So, and it's interesting to me, the way that all these things truly do tie together, especially once you start looking at, once again, those nine principles, the idea of, the idea of Reiki, things like that, all these things stem from these concepts of connection, these concepts of being able to share your energy, the idea of being able to feel somebody else's energy and help their energy.
Yes.
It's really fascinating. And to me, especially when it comes to, it's one of those, like, you're hard pressed not to be able to apply religious study to everyday life. And by religious study, I don't mean like study of the Bible, things like that. I guess I mean much more spiritual study. Yeah. Because it does help you get that trees and forest mentality, mm-hmm. you know? Now, when it comes to Psy Games, Hakeem, how are these principles being translated into I guess a working forum in that kind of way? Because there are definitely, you know, you've been to IRVA like I have. There are exercises that are done. There are outbounders, things like that. How are these abilities being measured at the Psy Games? How are we judging them? Things like that. How do these games actively work?
Yeah, so this is a very tricky topic because it's a game and we don't want to give away too much before sure. people actually play. We want it to be a surprise. And
well, we would be front loading if we did that.
Yeah, exactly. We'd be a front loading. Perfect way to put it. And so I will tell you that it's been a challenge, you know, and the reason why is that if we truly want to see, this is my opinion, my small opinion in a very gigantic world, right? If we want to see these abilities thrive and survive into the next generation, then we have to make them fun. Mm. We have to build a community around them. We have to make it fun because the people who are going to carry it on to the future is going to be the young folks, right? And so for adults who have disposable income and who can go and make our own mind up and decide that we want to go and try these things and do this thing, you know, we're happy with most anything. You know, if we just do a sit down and do a remote viewing, we'd be excited, right?
Yeah.
Like trying to get an 11-year-old to sit down and do a CRV session, that might be a little bit difficult, right? So it has to be exciting. However, scientists and researchers that don't always feel like the exciting way is the most rigorous way, you sure. know, for you to be able to do all of the research and stuff. So where's the the idea behind the Psy Games was in creating the games was trying to find that happy medium, right? Because skeptics are going to come out of the woodworks and Absolutely. They're going to say, this sucks, this thing, you didn't do this, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, okay, well, what's our overarching goal? Our overarching goal is to make this fun, to get people to challenge themselves, to build a community of, you know, where people can support each other and they can grow together. That's the overall goal. And then also to make sure that we maintain some level of scientific rigor yeah. so that anyone looking at it can see the potential. So if you come, Chris, and you do something, I can say, okay, this wasn't a perfect lab setting, but I mean, damn, they were pretty close. They had it like 50 or 60%. So if he sure. can do it, if he can do it here, even with a 60% type rigorous lab setting, then I'm pretty confident that he might be able to pull off the other 40 if I got him inside the lab and, you know, and did it, or at least he's not far off. That's better than starting at zero.
Yeah.
And because this person is willing to get up on stage and challenge themselves, then probably they'll be the type of person who would want to come and be researched and studied because they're outgoing and they're open and things of that nature.
Yeah.
That was really the goal. And so the games will test people in remote viewing, psychokinesis, mind sight, precognition, and then pendulum dowsing. And we have several different games that are set up. Some are digital and some are, you know, hands-on physical. And, you know, and we switch back and forth between those two so that we have multiple tests that we can kind of put people through, and then also someone looking, a researcher looking at it to get an understanding of what's going on can also pull from two different aspects of testing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, once again, the idea of marrying science with it, because yes, you know, once again, in a public setting, there's only so scientific as you'll be able to get. yeah. However, there's quite a bit that you can do at the front end to make sure that things are recorded in a scientific way, taken mm-hmm. care of in a scientific way, that the data comes out in a scientific way. Mm-hmm. But the idea of building that community, especially between researcher and practitioner.
Yes.
Because I think that there are quite a, much like IRVA this year started the professional side mm-hmm. of IRVA. Where you can go, you can do a few things and actually hit a registry with IRVA of professional and ranked remote viewers, mm-hmm. you know, because a part of the problem has always been like, how do I get tasked? Okay. Yeah. I've taken remote viewing training with Lynn Buchanan. I've taken the remote viewing training now with these people. And I've been to the IRVA conference a couple times. How do I now get tasked and become part of a remote viewing team?
Yes.
You know, how are those communities built? So once again, bringing together, and we both got to see a lot of stuff like that happen. Even relationships like this get built at the IRVA conference in Menlo yes. Park, which is hugely inspiring. And it was great the next year to see so many young people come because of its proximity to a college campus.
Yeah.
You know, where it was like a third of the audience was under the age of 30. And it was like, this is awesome. Yes. So the idea of bringing that younger generation in, giving them that opportunity. And as I said at the remote viewing conference this year on the cruise, somebody asked me, how do we bring remote viewing to the next generation? I literally said, make it a game. Give it rules. Give it rewards.
Yeah.
Like make it an app, you yes. know, but give it rules, give it rewards, and you will get them. You know, yes. like gamify it and absolute truth, you know. So the idea that this is also there within that community aspect to help build a common language, especially a generational language.
Yes.
For these things. How are because, you know, not that we're necessarily old, Hakeem, but we're definitely the midriff of this age group. You know, yeah. And it's kind of like whenever I walk into a conference and people are like, oh, look at this young buck. And I'm like, dude, I'm 50. I'm on your coattails as you walk out the door. You know, like we need to be looking at 25-year-olds and how do we bring them to this world of research? And yes. how do we generationally have a language, even internationally, have a language like science? You know, the main thing about science as we know it is the fact that there is a set of rules and regulations there that everybody internationally agrees to. There are yep. international measures that are used, you know, despite our standard system here in America. Mm-hmm. You know, so they have an international language that enables the science to progress. Mm-hmm. And how do we develop that international language within this remote viewing community? You know, yes. how do we develop, because it's going to be hard for a remote viewing group in Belgium to work with a remote viewing group in Texas if we aren't talking the same nomenclature. And if the nomenclature that we use doesn't directly translate to the same meaning in that yeah. other language.
Yes. Yes. That's so real. And that's so true. And that is the overall overarching goal of the SciGames. Is to make it fun, bring in the youth, and then start helping the youth and the adults, but find community and mentorship so that, like we talked about earlier, these folks who come out of the woodworks and start trying to shoot you down because you want to have or you want to explore your psychic nature, then okay, that's great. But I have a community that supports me in that, you know, and that's really what we're trying to build with the Psy Games is an international community that supports one another in these growth. And then also linking those who are young to mentors, strong mentors in which they can get with and they can learn these skill sets as well. And they can grow into the next generation. And hopefully after like the fifth or the 10th Psy game, what we start seeing, maybe the 10th, is that people who came in at 10, or even let's say 12 or 13, they came in at 13, 10 years later, they've been going to the Psy games this whole time. Now they're 23, they're graduating from college or something, and they decide they're going to start a family. Now they have a family. The conversation when their kid gets of age and starts doing these cool things where they say, I'm not sure, but I think I was looking at my friend over here. Or I was able to see through that wall. That's a different conversation with a parent who came up through the Psy game. So you get what I'm saying? Like, you're going to be, oh, that's great. Here's why that might have happened. And let's see if we can explore it and let's have fun. Whereas now I think it's a 50-50 shot. If you get a family, maybe a 60-40 shot, 40 being the low end, that you might get a family that supports it, but probably 60%, you're probably going to get a family that does not support it and say, shut that off. That's not real. That's fake. That's la la land or woo woo, or it's evil, you know?
And once again, I think that that is a huge cultural thing.
Yeah.
Massively cultural. You know, you hit the Hispanic population in South America, things like that. You are going to be talking a totally different reaction to such gifts than you are in New England.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fascinating to look at that. It's interesting to look at the demographic of that and the way that different people in the different cultures, you know, because even myself as Cajun, we have in our culture, the traiteur, the person that they were like the country healer that you went to, you know, who once again knew that balance and harmony of nature and would even give you some spiritual advice as they healed your wart, you know, and be like, you know, maybe while you're doing this and while you're following this regimen that I'm giving you to put this poultice on every day and say these things to give this intention, you should work on this spiritually too, because this may be an outward manifestation of something that you've brought into your life.
Yeah.
You know? And it's but not every Cajun in the Bayou is akin to that and good with that. There are many who are like, no, that's like Bayou witchcraft, you know? And there were definitely people in familial lines, things like that those things followed, you know? Yeah. So it's interesting to see that propensity of how these things follow in families. How, because my son has talked to things for quite a while and I don't dismiss it. I talk about it with him, you know, and make sure he has a good inner voice and knows who he is and what he stands for, things like that. But I'm not going to say that he doesn't hear those things, that he isn't more attuned to those things because he hasn't been put in a box his whole life, you know, and hasn't put himself in that box yet. So you have to consider that, and you have to consider the fact that yes, some people are encouraged to follow these gifts that they preternaturally have, you know, and other people are fully discouraged from it, be it for religious reason, what have you, just to loop this conversation around in the last 10 minutes, you know, because sadly, there are a lot of people who view these gifts.
Yes.
Hakeem, as horrible things, demonic things, bad things. And it's one of those like this is just your connection to physics. It's your connection to vibration. You know, the way I used to explain it to the junior high and high school kids I taught was when you walk into a room and you feel the kite string pull on the back of your belly button, pay attention. Yep. That may be a good feeling or a bad feeling, but you'll feel it.
Yeah.
You will feel the feeling like somebody pulled on a string on the back of your belly button, and you better perk up and listen.
Yes.
That either means you need to get out of there, and if your friends don't want to leave, weigh that and consider your real friendship with them, you know, because they may be trying to get you into something you don't need to be in, you know.
That's so true. I mean, those type of things are the things that we need for our youth to start and adults to start really listening. And, you know, this idea that, and, you know, I even in martial arts, I watched a video that came up on my feed the other day, and it was like, it was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. And this guy was talking about how you shouldn't do karate because the name is the name of the empty hand, meaning that you're emptying your hand so that, and by doing that, you're allowing a demon to be able to come in and possess you. And I'm like, where did this guy? And it was like it looked like a professional show that they were interviewing him on. They were having this real like dialogue. And I was like, what the hell is happening here? Like, are you kidding me? You're going to take somebody else's culture where they decided to call it empty hand because they were oppressed people and they didn't have weapons.
They weren't allowed to have a weapon.
And so they were like, our hands are empty. We're going to learn how to fight with our hands. And it became a thing called karate. Then now somebody's twisting that into like, you're emptying your hands so you can bring in a devil or a demon. It's like, you know, people will try to twist these things as a means to fear monger us out of our own power, you know, and exploring our own light in our divine light in a very true way, because it, you know, I'm going to say this very passionately, but also very compassionately. So I want to say that maybe it's a work. If as a PSYOP guy, which I am, if we were to say that there are dark forces out there and they want to control things, but this being is actually pretty powerful, right? But if we can overwhelm them with ignorance and fear, then we can scare them out of really developing and exploring their own potential. Then we can oppress them and we can, you know, we can do what we want to them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes I think that there might be a force that's saying these things as a means to scare generations out of tapping into their own ability. Now, I'm not saying that you can't have a moment where you, let's say, astrally project or go into a deep trance and bump into something that's not good, right? I'm not saying that, but I'm also saying that just saying everything across the board, doing that in general, just as a bad thing, means that you never are able to take control of an ability that you have. And what if those bad things that are out there try to mess with you, you don't have any way to deal with that because you didn't prepare or you didn't grow. And again, that's the darker side of this. I'm a warrior of light, and I want to be here to help people learn about that. But then also I have to keep in mind that there's probably some warriors for dark out there that want to do just the opposite.
Well, and you know, sadly and horribly, Hakeem, the only way that you can teach light is to understand the dark. You have to understand the dark mentality. You have to understand the dark reasons why people do things. And you have to be able to counterbalance that with love, light, compassion. Like you said, you know, even the fact of, hey, the color of this show is purple for a few reasons. Number one, it's the color of the crown chakra. That's where we should all be living. But politically also, it's the fact of, I'm purple. I'm not going to go to either extreme of the spectrum, infrared or ultraviolet. I'm going to stay right here in the middle.
Nice.
You know, right. let's stay in a balanced mentality. Let's mm-hmm. stay in a state where we are not all consumed by fear. You know, and one of the things I have hugely been shooting flares up in the last year about is a study by the National Institute of Health that came out right after COVID talking about the damage to your hippocampus from negative news cycles.
Mm.
The fact that it's basically like a barrage of trauma to your hippocampus that basically allows access to your amygdala. To the fight or flight response.
Yeah.
You know, so the more you look at the negative news cycles, the more you dwell on the negativity, the more you dwell on those things, the worse it gets. Literally, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, and you have to be able to teach that along with the light. You know, it's kind of like saying the example I give regularly is CE5.
Mm-hmm.
I am a firm believer that CE5 works. Sure. You get enough people with intenting on something, some things happen, you know. The question is, are we all sure that whatever just appeared doesn't have ill intent in mind?
Yeah.
You know, are we sure that it's something that isn't guising itself as what we've asked for? You know, so it's one of those, like, you've got to caveat it because it's on both sides. You see, either you're going to have the recoil response of you demonic sorcerers. What are you doing gathering people at a hotel and teaching them to do this and making them better at it? And then on the other side, people who are just as passionate. Let's say about their belief that there can possibly be no bad that comes of this.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to dwell in the middle. You've got to have the yin and the yang. You've got to find that true balance of exterior, interior, you know?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that I have a lot of friends in the consciousness space and we'll have conversations. And sometimes I'll have a friend who will say, like, you know, they'll talk a lot about balance, but then they don't want to believe there's any negativity in the world.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, wait a minute.
There's too much, you know?
I was like, there's a balance. That's what we said that. So that means there's good and not good out there. So let's come to that reality if we're talking about balance. Balance means balance, you know?
That's right. That's right.
There's two extremes or there's two things that are being balanced out or more than two things. But
And same thing with the word frequency. A frequency isn't just a tone. It's also a form of thought.
Mm-hmm.
How frequently are you thinking good frequencies?
Yeah.
You know, and I used to have a boss at the bar that I worked at that literally would – just like, hey, Jordan, you're always just shooting sunshine up people, you know? And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, I just try to find something good or a good reason that horrible things happen in the world. You know, if we can find a way to learn from it, maybe we won't repeat it.
Yeah.
Maybe we won't repeat the horror if we can find a way to learn from it, Hakeem, you know?
Yeah, so. I do know.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just that's one of the reasons why you pass these teachings and these principles on to youth. It's one of the big reasons why you work with youth in this field and pass these principles along. So I thank you for that because it is massively important shape them as they come up and give them a framework with which to grow. Let everybody know real quick, because we've got you for just a couple more minutes. Where can they go to get involved with PsyGames? Because you don't have to participate. If this is something that fascinates you, that is interesting to you, and you are in the area, you can absolutely come and volunteer. There will be need for volunteers, all kinds of stuff. So how can people come get involved? How can they tell their family about it? How can they come compete? How can they be a vendor? If they are in this space, time for shameless self-promotion about it.
We're looking for all of that. We're looking for vendors. We're looking for sponsors. If anybody want to see who's like, hey, you know, I just want to see this thrive. You know, they could be a sponsor. They could be a donator. We operate under a 501c3 called Questgate. They could have a product and they can get a vendor booth there. And then also we have a whole full day of lectures and workshops. So if you're just curious about learning, you could come in and you could just learn more from the professionals in the field. If you are good already, but you want to get better, you can get better by meeting with professionals in the field. If you have nothing and you just want to learn, you can come as well. So we have that. We have keynote speakers, which you're showing now. We have several keynote speakers that'll be talking about some really deep stuff. And we have these workshops where you can actually go hands-on and do some stuff. And then we have the games, which will be on a certain day where you can actually sit in as a spectator and see people compete in different, you know, skill sets and in these different psychic abilities. And so that's also going to be like a spectator event. It's going to be fun and a good time and people are going to have a blast. So we have that as well. So, I mean, it is just like over the top, just so many awesome things that we're going to be doing there and so many ways that you can get involved. And like you said, we're going to have a 20% discount code,
yep,
promo code to give people who are listening to this. If they just want to buy a ticket and bring their family, it's going to be at the Omni Hotel in Charlottesville, which is a beautiful hotel. And it's going to be right there next to the Department of Perceptual Studies at, you know, DOPS, which is the University of Virginia.
Awesome.
Which they've been one of the longest standing, you know, research groups for psychic abilities, you know, for a long time in the U.S. Yeah. And so they'll be there and their campus is really close to there, only like 10 minutes down the road. And we'll be doing for certain select people a walkthrough or a lab visit.
Oh, cool.
During that time as well, whoever wants to get on board with that. So yeah, we have that as well. So, I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot of cool stuff happening. And you go to PsyGamesInternational.com, which is PsyGamesInternational.com. So PsyGamesInternational.com.
Absolutely. And that code to save 20%, folks, is Chris, JPG125. That is Chris, JPG125. If you are interested in attending the Psy Games, use that code.
Sorry, it's not 125. It's J is PGI for Psy Games.
Oh, gotcha. There you have it. Much easier to remember. Chris J is in Jordan. PGI 25. So there you have it. That will get you 20% off. That is Chris JPGI25. So, yes. Hakeem, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for your candid honesty about such deep things, especially your work in the world of ninjutsu and training people in that. I find it absolutely awesome and incredible that I know an actual ninja. So,
I appreciate it. And, you know, I know somebody of your caliber and all of the amazing things you do with remote viewing and what you do with your show here and the speaking and also providing amazing AV for all different types of
organizations.
So,
well, I appreciate it. You take care, bud. We will be in touch soon with links and I cannot wait to come up to Charlottesville. It's going to be so much fun this year. I'm looking forward to it. So thanks as always, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Man, incredible conversation with Hakeem, folks. While you are online checking out everything from Psy Games International, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That is where you can find our store as well, where you can purchase all the books, videos, courses, things like that from our guests. That's also where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research. If you are a researcher in the world of cryptozoology, UFOs, UAPs, paranormal, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your back pocket data log to record all your field data so that it is ready in a scientific way to shake hands with science come that day. When we get back from this quick break, We will be joined by Edward Mong. We will be talking about Rob Moorhead and the Sierra Sounds, the famed recordings of possible Bigfoot activity in the Olympia Mountains. We will be talking about his experiences talking with Ron during his creation of the new Sierra Sounds documentary. And we will be talking about the Sierra Sounds, a prelude, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for holding on through that quick break. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com. They are your source for amazing CBD products. Christopher Lynch makes all of his products through a spagyric process, using and reusing every part of the hemp plant, everything from seeds, stems, stalks, to roots and buds. Every part of the plant is used, reused, then combusted and reused again until nothing remains, providing an amazing full-spectrum product, complete with terpene profiles and everything. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to save 7% with the code CURIOUS7 off your cart of $50 or more. While you're online checking out True Hemp Science, make sure to stop on by MerkleFilms.com. That is where you can find the all-new 20-minute preview documentary, Sierra Sounds, A Prelude. This is by our guest in this segment, Edward Mong, who is a former 82nd Airborne alumnus, as well as alumnus of New York Film Academy and the creator of Triangle Multimedia right here in San Antonio, just down the road. So welcome to the show, Edward. How are you today?
Hello, Chris. So good to see you. So humbling to be here again, brother.
Absolutely, man. Welcome back. We had a little bit of a recording issue the first time around, but I'm glad that you were able to come back, get things done. I've been, as the audience knows, I'm a massive fan of Skype. I use Skype regularly, and my dear beloved Skype is going away, Edward, and it's crushing my heart. So I have to get used to integrating Zoom into my system, and you were one of the first integrations, and unfortunately we had a little bit of a wonky issue. So thank you so much for coming back.
Anytime, Chris.
It also gave me a chance to go back today, because I always do guest prep day of show, so it's fresh in my brain. To go back and watch this Sierra Sounds documentary that you've made, at least the prelude to the documentary. And it's absolutely awesome the time that you got to spend with Ron Moorhead. Let's start at the beginning. How did you come to the world of documentary filmmaking to begin with, Edward?
Well, filmmaking's been in my head since I was little, since I was 7 years old. I remember I used to run around the house with a little photo camera, playing that is a film camera, making movies on my head, play with my cousins and playing with my brothers and, you know, neighbors. So I will say it came from many, many years ago. But I mean, professionally, when I used to live on the East Coast, I started filmmaking at the New York Film Academy. And I don't know, I just kind of apply what I learned into my favorite topic, which is, you know, anything related to the unknown. And that's how I ended up doing some of, you know, documentaries in this occasion for Ron Moorhead. But in the past, I did something for Stacey Brown. It's stuff that you can find on Amazon Prime, stuff like that. But yeah, this one here is basically one of my first ones I ever done regarding Bigfoot.
And you know, once again, it's one of those things that I think it's a big misconception with a lot of people when it comes to filmmaking, period, that a director necessarily has to have a personal attachment to a topic whenever it comes to documentary filmmaking, you know, that you have to have a personal interest in the topic or anything like that. Yes. Were you a believer in Bigfoot before you started this documentary process with Ron Moorhead?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm always believed that there's so much more than just humans and the galaxy to start with. And then after I met Ron Moorhead, especially because we run a little podcast back in the day, I met him through that. We talk about many, many different things regarding Bigfoot. He sent me some of the sounds, and man, he blew my mind. So I started to dig more and more in, you know, studying stuff, reading stuff, listening to other people's story. And even though I was already convinced that there's something out there, I did my own research. I mean, I'm a guy who been in the woods all by myself, you know, in the middle of the nowhere, late at night. I'm talking about Pennsylvania, Ohio, Washington State, Colorado, not Texas, not yet. That's the only state that I haven't been able to, you know, go out in the woods. But for the most part, I've been doing my own research because I do believe.
Now, when you say been doing your own research, in which field? In the world of cryptozoological research or UFO, UAP research? What exactly have you been out in the wild looking for, Edward?
I will say both, to be honest, okay. Chris. But I started with UFOs and aliens since I had my own experience back in 1994.
Okay.
That was absolutely the spark of everything.
Well,
you know,
let's explore that for a minute, because it is one of those that, you know, science begins with experience and mm-hmm. and inspiration begins with experience. So the fact that a personal experience for you is what led you down the road of this research to begin with, and even filmmaking for this kind of research and documentary or documenting this kind of research mm-hmm. in filmmaking, and through filmmaking, what was your experience, Edward?
Well, it's kind of long though, but I'm gonna have to squeeze it really tight. It was just a beautiful day, Chris. One of those Costa Rican days, you know. The sun is out, everybody's happy. You hear the chickens and all that good stuff around you. And Chris, I went home that day because I was not feeling good. I was at work. And then when I walk into my room, I'm 100% awake. I just laying down in my floor to cool down because I'm having a little bit of fever as well. And the floor is cold. It feels really good. So I put a black white sheet, lay down, and that was it. My body got paralyzed right there at the moment. And then I heard some weird noise, like an explosion right outside, right next to my window. And then I saw the glass is shattering all around my room like an explosion.
Wow.
And what's going on? So I tried to get up. I couldn't get up. I cannot move a finger, anything. And then from the window, in like a form of a waterfall, something started to crawl. And it's crawling down the window. It's coming to the floor, and now it's coming towards me, towards my legs especially. And the smell, Chris, the smell was, I mean, indescribable. Chemicals.
Mm.
I have never smelled anything like that I can really explain myself. But it stinks. Some chemical. That's what it was. So this thing is taking a form on top of me and forming up and forming and forming up, but it's huge. It's not just a regular, you know, being. I mean, this thing was going to get up, I would say maybe 8 to 9 feet tall. It wouldn't fit in the house. There's no way. So he was pretty much crouching or sitting down on top of my legs. Now, when I'm feeling not only the weight of this thing, but the coldness, because he's so cold, Chris, I can feel the cold going into my bones and then the pain just coming through my body all the way to my chest and to my head. And I'm screaming in pain, screaming because I'm scared. You know, I'm a young guy. It's 1994. I was 16, 17, something like that, maybe younger. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what to do. And I just praying in my head. And this thing is just staring at me, Chris. And then from nowhere, he just starts to raise his hand. And I saw the four fingers start to raise his hand and looking at his fingers like this. And then like a lightning speed, he just dropped the hand on inside my guts. And now I'm feeling pain. Now wow. I'm screaming for reals. And I don't know how long it took, but all I can see is it's like my room is narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. And now it's just me and this.
Oh, man.
I don't see no more walls. I don't see nothing. It's just like black all around us. Like a void. Kind of like that. But then I heard like an echo sound, like somebody knocking something far away. And this creature is looking at, like he can also hear it. And Chris, thankfully, my friend Gina, the one lady that I'm renting the room from, she left work as well. And she broke into my room because she walked into the house and she's listening to little Ed screaming like a kid. And she's wondering what's going on in there. She broke the door in pieces. And when she broke it, this thing just dropped like water on top of me, on top of the whole room, leaving some sort of like a gel covering the whole floor.
Oh, wow.
I'm talking about a lot, like a lot, Chris. I mean, I was wet in a way that, you know, like I just got out of the pool. Put it like that. When Gina pulled me out of my room, because I'm begging her, I can barely talk. I have no voice. I have no strength. I cannot even move. I sit down. Oh, sorry. When this thing dropped, it's like when you replace the movie. I mean, when you replay the movie in reverse.
Yeah.
It went down, back to the window, and I see the pieces of glasses back to what it was, like nothing happened. And then now Gina is in front of me. But I don't know who Gina is now because I'm all messed up. My brain, everything is messed up. And she's like, "Hey, this is me. It's me. What happened, baby?" And she's screaming. She's, you know, "Please take me out of here." So she took me out. I'm asking for water. And she's asking me, "What is this?" And her arms are full of this liquid stuff. And then I'm trying to go, you know, as fast as possible I can with the story, but there's a lot of details, Chris. And at the end, she told me, "Let's go to the ER." "I don't need to go to the ER. Ed, you're bleeding. You got hurt. What's going on?" And then she lifted up my shirt. And I got 2 holes in my abdomen, one on the right, one on the left. And whoa. I'm bleeding, like bleeding. And it hurts pretty bad, like pretty bad.
Yeah.
And then she asked me, "What is this in the room? What is that liquid stuff all over the floor? What happened?" And then I told her she didn't. I mean, how can she believe me? But at the same time, she's confused. Yeah, how did that happen? Sure. How are you hurt? What's going on here? And then she's panicking. She's "Let's get out of here." That was the last time we were in the house, Chris. We left. We left everything behind. We never even went to get anything back.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. It does beg the question, did anybody ever collect any of the material? Did you ever collect any of it? Was it there whenever you came back?
It's 1994, Chris.
Yeah.
in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
You go out and tell somebody about this, I'm going to be in the crazy hospital, number one.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Nobody will believe me anyways. I mean, when she told me that she was going to take me to the ER, I said, no, I don't want to go to ER because I'm already knew what's going to happen. I mean, I felt it. I'm serious. They're going to put me in a crazy hospital. I don't want that, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of let go. Those holes heal. I still have scars, believe it or not, Chris.
Wow.
I still have the scars. It's been many, many years. But since that day, I've been questioning myself, what happened? What was it? So when I moved to the United States back in 1998, 4 years later, my boss sent me to United States for a job. And I remember that I was watching TV, Chris, me and my brother. I don't know how it pops some alien face on the TV. I was grabbing dinner and I dropped it right there on the floor. I broke the dishes and everything. And I was shaking. He's like, what's going on? I froze. And then I told him, Alan, this is what happened to me. And I started to cry, panicking. And then he believed me. That's how I ended up, Chris, researching. Because for me, still affecting me until now. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah, no.
I get emotional every time because it bothers me. It just really bothers me.
It's an extreme moment in your life. And thank you very much for so candidly sharing in detail what happened to you, Edward, and how it affected you. Because even Bigfoot experiences. Yeah. And I mean, like, there have been a few people, I suppose, mm-hmm. along the way who have had physical contact with Bigfoot, things yes. like that. But even waking up and finding a trail of footprints that size outside of your tent and realizing something that large was there while you were asleep,
right.
Hearing noises, hearing tree knocks, stuff like that, like it can change you. In a way, and it's very interesting the way that our traumas take root in yeah. that kind of way, you know, and the fact that you are helping people document these experiences, Edward, mm-hmm. I had it explained to me by Reverend Michael J.S. Carter that mm-hmm. this was an extension of my time in the seminary and my work as a youth minister after. He was like, no, what you do is massively important. And right. this is part of a ministry for you. The idea that you help experiencers come forward and find answers and even come to peace with what yes. happened to them, you know. So it's massively important what you are doing. The idea of these documentaries of people's paranormal experiences and of Ron Moorhead's numerous experiences, because his experiences in the Sierra Mountains at his property were not just Bigfoot related. He had numerous experiences, paranormal experiences, experiences with orbs, all kinds of things. And it's fascinating. How did Ron first come across the property that ended up becoming his, I guess, encampment? Like, he ended up purchasing the property and owning it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he actually owned that property or not, to be honest.
Okay.
But I know that they have to ride horses all the way to yeah. the top of the mountain, you know. So back in the early 70s, late 60s, you know, a lot of people don't know Ron's story, but this is a wealthy man, you know, back in the day, a guy who owns hotels, planes, restaurants, gold mines, I don't know. Couple hundred employees, I guess. He was a well-known guy back then still. I mean, don't get me wrong, in a different path, but, you know, and he put up everything away to chase something that his buddies are telling him, man, let's go hunt. We want to show you something up there. He was not expecting that. He heard something about the sounds, but he was not sure about what it was. So here's Ron buying horses, buying, you know, hunting and gear and all that good stuff. And the next thing he knows, he's up there in the mountains with them, experiencing the same sounds. I mean, he told me the whole story, like face to face. And wow, you can feel the emotions, you know. It's just different when you read the book, but having the man telling you the whole story, Chris, it really drags you into his world. And then you know that there's no BS about it, you know. I had a blast with him. I spent the 6 weeks at his house when he was living in Washington State. We were doing some film work, that's why. And then, Chris, I can tell you, this man went through a lot. And I got a lot of respect on Ron because he left pretty much everything that he had in the past to chase something that you and I both know that these things are real.
Yeah.
And they're among us, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's that is something that I say on the show regularly, personally, that I believe that there is a actual large hominid creature roaming the woods of North America and beyond. Mm-hmm. But I also think that there is something else there that will gladly use the tropes of our mind. And I think that with whether you call it CE5 contact, you know, mm-hmm. the idea of summoning craft, talking to craft, things like that. I think that there is a fine, fine line between these things, you know, and that there is something else there, almost interdimensionally, that will gladly use what we would be comfortable with, because it's much more comfortable for our eyes than the horror of what we would see or what they like. It would just, you know, divergent our mind, so to speak, to actually see them in their reality. So and even Ron Moorhead's concept of that I have fully adopted, the idea that yes, perhaps even a Sasquatch is using subharmonic frequency to mask themselves. 19 hertz specifically is the frequency, one frequency below human hearing, but it's also where distortion in our eye water begins and where optical illusions begin, stuff like that. So the idea of an animal being able to use a subharmonic frequency like that, basically like communication, like whales, elephants, lions, that kind of stuff. But being able to use it in a way knowing that it is a defense.
That,
you know, whenever something sees it, it can use this frequency and disturb its vision and suddenly it vanishes, you know.
They do, yeah. And you know what's funny about all of this, Chris? Well, maybe not funny. That might not be the word, but the thing is, we are so close-minded, and I'm talking about humans in general. But just like we talked before, man, when you go and let's say you need to study a case, or let's say murder case, something like that, an investigator have to walk into that place with an open mind. You have to. It's the only way that you're going to find out what really happened there.
Yeah.
You got to have an open mind. You cannot just, you know, walk in there and, oh, this is what happened and that was it.
Yeah.
No, that's not how it works. You have to have that open mind in order for you to have, or maybe get into that level of frequency that you can understand what really is going on behind stage. Ron, other than voices, this is a man who heard things, metal sounds, in the sky or in the ground. We don't know. I kind of experienced something similar, so I'm related to that. This is a man who saw lights. I mean, so close to them, just going in a very slow motion, you know, and they saw it disappearing in front of their eyes in the same Sierra camp, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not just about the Sierra sounds. It's all the mystery behind. It's all about all the things going on up there, you know?
Yeah. And there are quite a bit of things going on up there, especially once you get into geomagnetic activity, you know, volcanic activity, things like that. And there are numerous, especially as far as plasma balls, things like that, orbs, so to speak. Those are regularly reported near fault lines, volcanoes, things like that, because of the idea of superheated gases, mm-hmm. you know, superheated plasmas, stuff like that. And when you're talking about a large geomagnetic anomalous area, like the Olympia Mountains, things like that, there's quite a bit that goes on in the Pacific Northwest geomagnetically, quite a few areas that compasses go awry, things like that. And even as we've talked about on numerous shows, when it mm-hmm. comes to Bigfoot, the idea that most of that area is unsettled. There are large swaths that are still rainforest, things like that, untouched rainforest, and mm-hmm. even planes with transponders go missing up there. They crash. They know where their last location is. They cannot get to them.
Mm-mm.
Because
at least not right away.
Yeah, yeah. And if ever at all, you know, frequently they'll find the craft, but by that point, people have started walking somewhere and they can't find the bodies, yeah. you know, stuff like that. So it's not a place where things that are strange isn't beyond the norm. And to know, even to know yeah. that Ron Moorhead numerous times went out there like by himself mm-hmm. to do stuff. And to do research, that in and of itself takes a certain amount of chutzpah.
Yeah,
you know there was.
You know, I asked Ron one time, Ron, do you think there's a Stargate or some sort of a portal up there? And he looked at me. We were drinking coffee that morning. I remember that. He stopped drinking coffee. He's staring at me, just staring at me. And he's like, "Ed, honestly, that's what I believe. There's got to be not only one, but many, many of those up there." So there is a lot of stuff, Chris, that we don't understand as humans. You know, we're still babies. We're flying almost to Mars now, but we still don't know anything. We think we know, but we don't know anything.
Yeah.
We don't even know our own planet yet, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, a good 80% of our ocean is still unexplored. And even whenever you I'll bring it up right now, because this is an image that I regularly bring up whenever we're talking Sasquatch, Bigfoot. And that is U.S. at night from ISS. And if you look at a still image of that, of the United States at night from the International Space Station. There's a lot of unsettled United States, folks.
Wow. Yeah.
That happened to be right there where a lot of Bigfoot sightings happened. You know, wow. Like there's a lot of the Pacific Northwest where you don't see lights at night, you know, things like that. And quite literally, one of the articles that just came out not too long ago was the two hikers that died of exposure looking for Sasquatch in Oregon. I mean, this was December. So, like, these are things not in ancient history where people go missing going up there. People go up there, they get lost. They may have been going to their regular Sasquatch spot, Ed, you know, that they went to regularly to go hunt, that they had marked on a GPS, something like that. But it doesn't mean once you get around magnetic anomaly or something like that, that your GPS doesn't go wonky or that your GPS battery doesn't die. Or that your hard compass doesn't go crazy or is off and now you can't get back properly, you know? So the fact, once again, that Ron went out there like solo and got a lot of this stuff and had these experiences, like there's a big tip to the hat there.
Yeah.
Not necessarily something that you would recommend as far as survivalist situation or typical hiking situation goes. You know, especially in that kind of area. But it's definitely one of those puts things on a different level, you know.
Definitely.
And let's get into some of the sounds that were actually recorded. Do you mind if I play a quick clip from this?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So.
Notes and stuff like that. And eventually I just was laying there in my sleep bag wondering. I heard this chatter going on about 10 o'clock at night.
Oh,
It's a big picture.
And as an audio engineer, Edward, I have to hand it to you. Very, very good job cleaning that. Because there was quite a bit of background noise, things like that, from the old equipment that was used to record it. But very, very fascinating vocalizations. And that once again is just a sample. Like you said, you have tons of that stuff locked away from Ron that has never even seen the light of day, aside from the fact of being given to scientists and stuff like that to examine. So what do you make of the vocalizations that were picked up during the not only the original Sierra Sound sessions, but all the way until Ron's? Then that's a lot of what you're talking with him about, is the idea of him doing 50 years of research out at this property all the way up till like 2016 and even a little bit after that. So what do you make of those vocalizations over that period of time, Edward?
I kind of learned from Ron that in the beginning, I was feeling uneasy, you know, that kind of a little fear. And it's funny because that's how Ron feels like at the beginning. But when you get to listen to the whole thing and you get deep into it, you ended up loving it. You kind of feel like you're part of it. Because, I don't know, because you're so curious, I guess. You want to know more. You want to hear more about it. And you're trying so hard to understand at least one word, but there's nothing in there that you can understand. So, I don't know. It really opens my mind to see, once again, Chris, how tiny we are, how small we are. Absolutely. Versus nature, versus the universe. There are, you know, Bigfoot chattering around, talking about, who knows? Just like Ron says, hey, we were just in our bunker, and we hear these creatures talking, having a conversation.
Yeah.
Sometimes they sound like they're mad at each other. And they even put names on, there were like three of them. I forgot the names right now.
Yeah.
But they got a young guy, one of the youngest. He was the stupidest. He's always getting closer and closer to them. like a kid, maybe so curious about it.
Yeah.
So Ron says that the mom is the one actually telling, because she's far away, pretty much like trying to keep them away from, you know, from the camp. But it didn't work. You know, days later, they're just walking right next to them. Mm. I mean, there's pictures that I have in the hard drive that Ron gave me, though, that it really make you think how someone can fake this up. How can somebody make this up? There's no way. It's so real. You got the sounds. You have the conversations between them, and you have the voices of Ron and the guys talking to them, you know,
and the like sound, overlapping. The sound specifically, and that's something that Ron says in the interview during the 20-minute. And granted, folks, this is once again a prelude. It is a preview to the documentary. It's about 20 minutes long, but very compelling, and I think it lays a really good groundwork of what the full documentary is going to be about and the breadth of what it covers. And when you start talking, when you start hearing him saying that, like, eventually he started talking to the voices as though it was like his brother, you know, not out of fear or anything like that, or yelling for it to go away, or what are you doing, or anything like that, but just having a conversation with it, you know, the same way he would with his brother or a good friend, you know, and that is what led to the success of getting so many recordings at that location. It's fascinating when you start considering that, especially when you start listening to the, once again, the scientist, the NASA scientist who got a hold of the vocalizations years ago and was like, this is, he was a linguist. That's like, these are not sounds that the human voice can make. So it's not a primate that we know. It's not like a known primate or a combination of primate grunts and gruttles, you know, or things like that. And it's definitely not ranges. Many of the ranges are things that the human vocalization range cannot hit. So it's not like it's a human making it, or a human combined with ape sounds, or something like that. It is, as far as we know right now, an unknown species that is on tape. And it's interesting. And there have been numerous people throughout the years. Don't get me wrong, folks. Much like the Patterson-Gimlin film, anything else, there have been numerous naysayers about these recordings throughout the years. Don't get me wrong. However, I don't know. As an audio engineer and somebody who's worked in audio recovery for years and years, things like that, it doesn't really sound like an assemblage to me. It sounds like a actual field recording, and amazingly captured. You know, once again, whenever you go back and listen to it, it's fascinating, fascinating stuff. And to know that he has tons of this. The first things were released back on 45. Like I did an archivization for the Hayden Hughes files, and one of those things was an analog recording from a 45 record of the Sierra sounds. It's pretty fascinating to know that it's been around that long and that this work with him has been around that long. So, as you got to spend time with Ron and hear these stories and stories from other people that were there, things like that, Edward, what was your overall impression of these experiences?
Well, I remember coming back from Washington, and recently last year when I filmed this part of the documentary, to me, it's always emotional. It's always emotional because two reasons. Number one, Ron's friendship. Ron has been a good friend to me for quite a few years now. And this is a man that is, you know, he's in that age. And every time we talk, he's always, you know, it almost sounds like a goodbye to me, which I'm always mad at him. Mm. I'm like, don't say that. But he's just laughing. He's like, no, Ed, I'm leaving a legacy and I want people to continue on. So for me to do some work like this for Ron, it's a privilege. He's a legend to me. And I know that it is for a lot of people as well. I respect him a lot. I love the man. He's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
And I mean, just the story itself, to me, it's one of the most compelling stories I ever heard. And this is exactly why I went out and shoot it. You know, I really want to be part of this. I want to leave a little of my work.
Well,
attached to him.
You know, there's something interesting, though, about being a documentary filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, like regular filmmakers tell stories. They definitely do. Both fiction and nonfiction filmmakers. However, documentary filmmakers specifically share in a very specific line of storytelling, you know, and it's that almost tribal storytelling, yeah, where it's like you're trying to tell and convey a story so that, yeah, future generations understand it, so that the next, yeah, realm of researchers understand these situations and these recordings in a different way. Like, yeah, I just spent a whole day during South by Southwest with First Nations House talking about the idea of storytelling and the idea of passing these things along culturally. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, and how these things get passed along. And right now, in a lot of cultures, especially westernized cultures, those things, mm-hmm, are not happening. You know, like Mardi Gras, mm-hmm, just passed. I'm Cajun. You're hard pressed to find a Cajun my mother's age or younger that speaks the Cajun language. It's almost dead.
Wow.
And it's one of the only languages native to America. You know? So, yeah, so like, storytellers like you have unique opportunities to be able to talk with researchers like Ron Moorhead, who have years of encounter stories,
years
of hard,
years.
Yeah, 50 years of hard research encounter stories out in the field, grabbing these things, getting these recordings, doing stuff like that, and being able to pass that along in a way that invigorates the next generation of researchers and piques their interest in a new way. You know, so thank you for the work that you do. I think a lot of people dismiss the world of documentary filmmaking. And it's one of those, like, it's truly shares in a old tradition of storytelling and passing down of tradition.
Well, I'm humble. Thank you so much for your words, Chris. It really means a lot. It's nice when somebody actually get the time and watch your work, because I've been putting my time, my money, my effort, my love, my passion, everything behind this computer, you know, from finding the stories, building a set, you know, building a team, editing, music score, VFX. It takes a lot of work, a lot of effort. But I'm grateful. I'm very grateful, because at the end of the story, Chris, I just want to put a little bit of my work out there through a story that I love so much, and that's Ron Moorhead's story. So people should give it a shot. They should watch it, you know?
It's really, once again, very, very well done. And I think a lot of people have great expectations when it comes to different types of documentaries and different documentaries. And it's not necessarily, folks, that you will hear anything new beyond the Sierra Sound recordings as they were released. Okay. But what you're going to hear is the experience of 50 years of getting those recordings, going to that location, what that meant, how that motivated him to other research, things like that. And once again, hearing that from Ron's own words.
Yeah.
I think it's very important for us to interview these people, get these literal elders in community. You know, it's very interesting to me. One of the ways I explain a lot of these communities is like my Knights of Columbus Council. You know, whenever I come in, they're like, "Oh, look at this young buck. Let's get him involved." And it's like, "Hey, man, I'm 50. I think you need the 25-year-old. Like, not that I'm not vigorous and alive and, you know, out there and doing stuff, but I'm on your coattails.
Yeah.
Like, I'm only 15 years behind you. We need to look at the next 50 years of this research, not the next 5 or 10. That's very short-sighted, you know? So we need to be looking at the next generation and the one after, and how do we invigorate them to come to this research? Because you've already got me and my generation. You've had us since before X-Files, you know?
That's right.
Like, you've had my generation since V in 1984, okay? Since Bigfoot on $6 Million Man, like that's when we first found out about these topics, you know. So you've had us for the longest time, but how do we, beyond the realm of pop culture, Edward, take this real research, this real field research by people like Ron Moorhead, Adam Davies, stuff like that? How do we bring it to the next generation and make it popular beyond a social media feed? How do we get them interested in it beyond finding Bigfoot, you know? Things like that. That's my question. So, how do you see yourself as a filmmaker able to possibly make that happen?
Well, like I say, I'm a storyteller. I enjoy every single story. I don't care if it's a short story, a long one. But I think it's important for any filmmaker to put their own, their own flavor to the film, you know?
Sure.
You have to take any story and bring something new, something refreshing. I mean, I don't want to be just a regular guy doing the same old thing from the guy behind me. I think we need to step up and do better things every day. As you know, Chris, technology is in the change. It's changing every day.
Yep.
So we should do the same thing. The only thing that we cannot change is the story. You know, that's what I told Ron. Let me take this little story from you. I'm not going to tell the whole story, you know, because it's huge. But let me take at least the chapter. When you're closing this chapter of your life going into the woods as a researcher, he's still writing books. He's still traveling. He's still doing a lot of different things.
still does a lot of speaking at events.
Oh, yeah. But I want to show people how you close that chapter of your life through this documentary. And he was happy about it. So,
well, and that's just it. How do you cap something like that? How do you decide, like, my time of field research and going to the Sierra camp are done, you know? Right. And once again, kind of redefining yourself. Like, how do you, you've defined yourself as a field researcher for so long. How do you define yourself now, you know, as once again, an elder in a community, you know? Yeah. And by that, I mean like elder of wisdom and knowledge, mm-hmm. you know, because of his sage years of work out in the field and even, once again, bringing the world of paranormal to Bigfoot, because there's a whole world of that now that 20, 30 years ago, I don't think that there were as many reports as there are now. I also think that they're much like the drone situation.
Yeah.
It's one of those, once you now know what a drone looks like and you know that you should be looking for them and be looking up for them. You'd be surprised how many you see, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you realize that, hey, there may be another paranormal phenomena going on with Bigfoot, and you start hearing about that, you may start mm-hmm. seeing that more and more. And if, once again, even the idea of orbs being on that property, there was.
And this is the importance of making a film. Remember, we, as you do with the podcast, is the same thing. You're opening the window for people to come forward and share their stories. You know how many people die a year without telling their stories, Chris?
Too many.
And it's kind of sad, you know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, you want to say something to somebody, and these people have to swallow that.
Yeah.
So we're opening a window, and that's what I'm trying to do here, trying to open a window for people like Ron and like anybody else to share their story. So, because you know what? At the end of the day, Chris, this story might change somebody's life. That's the way I see it.
Well, and it's one of those, it's like I told my wife, the importance of sharing your story is that it may encourage somebody else to share theirs. Mm-hmm. You know, and sharing that story, even though it may be painful for you, even though, and thank you very much once again for sharing yours, even though it still obviously affects you, Edward. Like I saw you reliving some of that as you were going through that, because these things, they are traumatic. They are life changing. They change you in totally different ways. And, you know, even my experiences that I've had in life, it's one of those, even if they are proven to be something else, it doesn't change my view of the experience when it happened and how it changed me in perpetuity from that point forward in the way that I view the entire world and interact with the entire world, you know, and some of those things, yes, may be traumatic, specifically because our brains are programmed to follow a negative pathway, you know, they're programmed to follow that trail of negativity, as a means of survival, you know? So it's one of those, you're helping other people survive. You're helping other people get through and have the courage to come forward with their story.
Yeah.
It's very interesting how over the last decade, and specifically over the last 5 years, how there has been a windfall of reports of not just UFO UAP activity, Edward, but paranormal activity, cryptozoological activity, things like that, Bigfoot activity. And once again, I think a lot of that is people who are now not reticent to share their story. They are willing to come forward. They no longer either care if people call them crazy or they now know that they're not crazy.
And Chris, even if they don't share the story, at least they know that they got a place to go.
That's right.
And listen. And that might bring some peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like when you go to church, sometimes you're not up front every day or every Sunday, but at least you go and you kind of feel better because now you got the word that your soul's been looking for. Mm. So I would say this is basically the same thing because we're all humans. We all need each other at some point, Chris.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And if people like you, like me, we go through something in life and we can take that experience to share it with somebody, for sure, man, sooner or later it's going to help that person. We're going to learn from their mistakes and maybe avoid something that, you know, we're still in time to avoid it. That's my point.
Well, and that's just it. That's just it. You know, we tend to go down a lot of rabbit holes in life. Yeah. And it can be hard not to go down them, and especially negative rabbit holes after experiences, you know. So for you to be able to present somebody's 50 years of experiences, for you to once again be working on the paranormal experience or documentary and UFO experience or documentary like you are, things like that. Those are important because it helps other people. Yeah. Tell their story and be willing to come forward with their story. And that's what I've said about whenever we had Earl Grey Anderson on talking about the Napolitano abduction, the Netflix documentary that was done that Peter Robbins and other people ended up suing Netflix because they came to them. They came to Miss Napolitano and said, like, we would like to do a documentary about this. And it ended up basically being a smear job where they were doubting her experience. That is not the veil under which they contacted them or anything like that. And I'm like, you know, I understand you want to get a bomb documentary out. Your main other person was the ex-wife of Bud Hopkins, the investigator, you know, and she was also one of the producers on the film. So all kinds of things like that. But it's also, what does that do for the community? You know, what does that do for the experiencer who may want to come forward with their story and sees that?
That's true.
And sees how this experiencer has been treated. You know, it doesn't really necessarily make you want to come forward and share a story. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like it may be a form of documentary filmmaking, no doubt. Don't get me wrong, but it's not a form of documentary filmmaking that is healthy for the experiencer community.
Right. Well, you know? there's many types of documentary for what I see so far. Yeah. There is the fictional and commercial, you know. Yep. People take a story just to make money and that's all they care about. So they will change the script. They will come up with some other stuff that, you know, it shouldn't be there. Like, I forgot his name, man. Is it Walter? I don't know. This man who were adopted by aliens in Arizona. You remember him?
Oh, you're talking about Travis Walton.
Travis Walton. There you go. When Hollywood took his story, remember, they changed the whole thing at the end.
Oh, yeah. Like the whole scene in the spaceship is totally different, like all kinds of things. And they totally rewrote it, you know. So, exactly. And there's a lot of sensationalism and a lot of that put in. And once again, when you're putting sensationalism and shoe dropping twists like that into a documentary about an experiencer, it doesn't make the experience of coming forward with your experience very opportune. It doesn't really make you want to do it, you know? So good folks like you that are out there that are studying these experiences, that are studying the paranormal experiences, like what's being shown on screen from the Sierra camp with Rob Moorhead and his wife, things like that. It's great because it explores the topic in an open-minded, open-hearted way. It shows the fact that there are connections to other sides of this and other facets other than just a physical hominid walking around in the woods. You know, that there's something else going on there as well. That there's a whole panoply of things, and that all of these things changed Ron and changed the way that he looked at the world and changed the way that he processes the world. and considers these things. So good on you, man. Amazing work with the documentary. It's been fantastic. Once again, to go back and watch it again for a second time was really, really great. And I got to absorb a whole lot more of what the real width and breadth of it is going to be as far as the release. When does the full documentary drop, Edward? Because, of course, right now you can go get Sierra Sounds a Prelude right over on MerkelFilms.com. That is MerkelFilms.com, folks. Merkel Films. So when does the full documentary drop?
Well, my goal was for 2025, but I'm not going to lie, Chris, I'm a little behind schedule due to, resources and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So definitely I will say 2026. And like I mentioned to you before, this is the documentary not only regarding Rome Moorhead. In fact, the name is going to be Unknown Encounters. It's going to be related to UFOs, alien adoptions, Bigfoot. And there's going to be one story of regarding paranormal. Oh, and one NDE.
Wow.
One NDE, yeah.
Okay.
So I want to give a little bit of choices to people. Get to see what's the unknown to all of us. And so they can have choices to watch, you know, different topics, different chapters that they can go through and see what's their thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's important for any filmmaker to bring stories that are compelling and more than compelling, true stories. So that's what I'm doing, Chris.
Well, and two amazing, amazing kudos, man, because the film work is fantastically well done. The shooting is amazingly well done. Everything is top notch. Absolutely amazing work. Thank you so much for putting this out there and for doing this, because I think it's really important to be able to, once again, see things from the point of view of a researcher like this and an arching story of how they have changed their realm of research and why they've changed it and what they believe and why they believe it. It's fantastic. So a beautiful, beautiful lens into the mind of a researcher with this, Edward. Where can people go to follow all of your work with Triangle Multimedia out of San Antonio?
Well, at this point, like you were mentioning, MerkelFilms.com. That would be the way to go. As of right now, TriangleMultimedia.us will be the next one. It's in the making right now.
Okay.
But if people want to connect directly with me, they can always find me on Facebook. I got a page over there, Edward Munch. That's how you guys can find me. And, you know, I'm always keeping my page with new posting, you know, like updates regarding the documentaries and stuff. So that's what I'm going to be doing for the next next year or so, sharing what's next to do.
Well, I want to thank you so much for everything that you are doing. Once again, it's great. It's fantastic to see this stuff being done, these stories being told. So thank you for everything that you do, Edward.
No, thank you, Chris, for having me. And thank you for opening, again, a window for me.
Absolutely. Anytime and always, my friend. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Edward Munch and Triangle Multimedia over at MerkelFilms.com with the Sierra Sounds of Prelude, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find the Curious Realm store, where you can find all of the binaural beat music, books, films, classes from our guests, as well as your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, or UFO UAP, this is your back pocket data log to be able to enter all of your data in the field as it happens, so that it is ready to shake hands with science come the day that that is needed. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what it takes for humanity to march forward. Without that, we don't march forward. So Thank you so much for the conversation and the open minds. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.